If you've been told to pull up your socks recently, then make sure it's a pair of RCR socks. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/shop.
Dr. Michael Bassett is a political historian with a depth of knowledge like no other. We talked earlier with Sandra Gowdy about his article, so let's get his views on the Waitangi Tribunal, Tikanga, and the goings-on at Kāinga-ora. Michael joins me now. Welcome back to The Crunch, Dr. Michael Bassett. Good to have you back.
Pleasure.
We're going to touch on quite a few things, but before we get going, you would have seen the news about Kāinga-ora and the billions of dollars in the red that they are. And I'm thinking, you know, back to the dark days of Muldoon and thinking that this previous Labour government over 6 years have really performed a level of economic sabotage that is on a scale, you know, obviously in today's dollars, with what Robert Muldoon did. The sole exception, of course, being Robert Muldoon actually built something.
Well, Robert Muldoon was his own Minister of Finance.
Yeah.
And he kept a slightly better sort of eye on the budget than Grant Robertson. I mean, the $80 billion dollars that was borrowed and then flung around the place recklessly, extraordinary, really. And where now everybody's grizzling and up in arms at the thought that somehow or other we might try to live within our means. If they ran their domestic budget the way they want the government to run the country's budget, we'd be in a fine shape.
I find it astonishing that the Labour Party come out and, you know, Christopher Hipkins made a speech on the weekend, and it's like nothing happened nothing did happen in the last 6 years, but it's like he's expecting us to forget the excesses of that government. As you say, the money that was flung about with gay abandon and caused huge amounts of inflation. And they're sitting there thinking that they were these wonderful stewards of the economy. But the facts are now leaking out all over the place. Kāinga-ora is just the latest one, where it's apparent that there was a systemic problem in the cabinet, in that ministers weren't on top of their portfolios and keeping a track on what was going on in these government departments.
Well, my own feeling is that about half of the cabinet of Jacinda's and Hipkins weren't really on top of their portfolios. And I mean, the last year saw the most extraordinary collection of crises, from Michael Wood to Kerry Allen, there were others as well who just sort of fell over and weren't really properly in control.
Yeah, if you look at Kāinga-ora and housing, the two ministers that were in charge of that for pretty much half each of the 6 years were Phil Twyford and Megan Woods, both of whom were the campaign chairs for various elections for the Labour Party. And yet this massive portfolio of which they hung their hat on for their election campaign with Kiwi Build and then extending state housing is an unmitigated disaster.
Well, you said it. I wouldn't in any way disagree.
Have you seen anything since we last chatted? And I'm going to ask you each time we chat, have you seen anything to change your mind that this was the worst government in living history?
No, I said as much when they were in office, and I still think that certainly the worst government since the war, the Second World War, weakest government too, in the sense that Labour usually, certainly it did in the 70s and the 80s, have some reasonably talented people. But things went dreadful. Even under Helen Clark in the beginning of this century, you know, there were some pretty competent people in that, in her government. But that competence level just sort of faded completely. And they did no work between 2008 and 2017. I mean, I found that business of setting up 240 committees to work over what they should do now that they were in office just bizarre.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that they did do is make some changes that have has enabled a few Maori radicals to start to what from where I'm looking at it from looks like essentially like a bloodless constitutional coup is underway in our justice system and in our universities and in society in general, all hanging around this fanciful idea that there was a partnership between, you know, the head of the British Empire at the time and a disparate group of warring Maori iwi.
Yes, well, that's certainly what it looks like. But the real question is whether the government, this government, since the last government didn't, has this government got the intestinal fortitude to knock it on the head?
I'm not sure that Christopher Luxon does have the stones to do that, but I'm pretty sure that Winston Peters and David Seymour and Shane Jones have got the willingness to do it. It's whether or not they're allowed to do it.
Yes, quite. Well, that's going to be the real test. And it would be a great pity if the government came to the end of its time and hadn't really made it perfectly clear that the government, the elected government, was in power and had the sole right to make decisions, and that there was no such thing as co-government because Maori had ceded sovereignty in 1840. That's what it's really about.
Yeah, it's this heroic assumption that sovereignty was never ceded that seems to have grabbed the attention of media mainly and a few Maori radicals, and a lot of them are coalescing inside the Maori Party. They've got this idea that there was this co-governance arrangement. And by staying silent, people who oppose that are letting it happen.
Hmm. Well, certainly that's what it looks like. Quite where and how their version of the treaty, where it's to be found and what precisely it says, I'm unaware. All I do know is that the only translations of the treaty that I've seen, of the Maori version, make it absolutely clear that sovereignty was ceded forever in 1840, and therefore there is no argument for co-governance. And what Maori have got to do is argue, and I think they can legitimately, that anything that has to do with them, they should be consulted, or the appropriate Maori should be consulted.
The right kind of Maori.
Well, that's a different from saying that a handful of self-appointed Maori leaders should be able to wield 17% of the power on behalf of people who have never elected them in any way, shape or form to speak for them.
I was talking to Sandra Gowdy earlier, and she was talking about an article that you wrote on your website, Bassett, Brash and Hyde, about a Maori push for parallel government structures. And I was in the middle of talking to her about it, and I thought, I actually should just get you on and talk. It's good to get somebody else's perspective of what you wrote, but it's good to find out the thinking, because without blowing smoke up you, you're one of the biggest thinkers in New Zealand politics that I've ever met or known. And I read your article about this Maori push for parallel government structures, and most of it being done through the Waitangi Tribunal and their, I hesitate to call it judicial activism because they're not a body that's part of the judiciary, but they think they are. And that's the thrust of your article, isn't it?
Yes, it is. Karen Fox, is it? Karen Fox, is that her name? Yes. Karen Fox seems extraordinarily self-important and, you know, the feeling that somehow or other we're on some kind of mission. I think it possibly goes with the MoCo, and she certainly has got a head of steam on. But, I mean, the last government, rather the last national government, was actually contemplating 10 years ago getting rid of the Waitangi Tribunal, because the historical claims were over. And there were only a handful of claims which could be advanced, day-to-day claims. But somehow or other, they've just simply decided they're a court and that they'll be whatever they're, the people that come to see them, they'll simply decide in their favour. I don't think under Karen Fox or under any of her predecessors going back into the 1990s, I don't think the Waitangi Tribunal has ever turned down a case.
Yeah, they take the case, they mark their own homework and then deliver what they call as a judgment that have, you know, far-reaching implications. And perhaps the most significant one in recent memory is the Maori is the foreshore and seabed issue that was made as a claim to the Waitangi Tribunal, and then they came out and said, yes, that's what we're going to do, and then that caused a massive problem for Helen Clark.
It went to the High Court. That was Sian Elias who made that decision, I think, in 2003 and caused the problem that led on to the foreshore and seabed legislation. But the legislation that Clark's government pushed through was thoroughly sensible, but unfortunately it was undone 6 years later. And so we're living with a situation now where slowly but surely quite large parts of the coastline in New Zealand seem to be being given permanently to Māori.
There was a John Key government that undid all that as part of their, you know, bribe, I guess, to the Māori Party to garner their support. And it leads a lot of people to question whether or not National will sell out to Māori interests at the drop of a hat when it suits them.
Well, I have the same suspicion.
I'm not at all confident that Christopher Luxon wouldn't do the same thing.
Well, I mean, the interesting thing that I touched on in that article that you were referring to, he seemed to be unaware of what the status of the Waitangi Tribunal really was. And when he got, he censured a couple of his ministers for criticising the judiciary, he didn't, when they criticised the Waitangi Tribunal, he didn't seem to know that the Waitangi Tribunal was not part of the judiciary.
Well, what's stupid about that from Luxon's point of view is he was reacting to a farcical presumption by Thomas Coughlin that this was the judiciary and that they'd breached the cabinet manual, which is a joke. It's just not possible.
Well, that's right. Thomas Coughlin, of course, is a pretty good journalist, far better than most of his colleagues. But be that as it may, he did get that one wrong.
Yeah, and then that led to Luxon trying to tell off David Seymour and Winston Peters, who both probably laughed at him quietly in the background. But, you know, you mentioned in this article that it appears to be an attempt. It's like there's a slow-moving strategy. The first tactic would seem to be to try and get themselves declared as a court. And so they need to create an issue for them to then be able to progress that. And that issue was, let's see if we can get a minister summoned to the tribunal to answer questions or be harangued or whatever they plan to do over government policy that a government was elected to enact. And they were trying to insert themselves into the political debate. Then that, of course, went to the High Court, and then we've got this judgment that's saying, well, yes, the High Court agreed and said, no, you can't summons a minister. And then it went to the Court of Appeal, and then we got this outrageous decision that basically achieved what the Waitangi Tribunal was trying to achieve, which was to get themselves lifted above quasi-judicial to actually being part of the judiciary.
Well, we have a very serious problem developing with our judiciary, the upper echelons of it. Mm. I'm not quite sure whether it was sloppy appointments by both National and Labor. I suspect it was both parties that have been responsible for putting people who were not fit and proper onto the court. We're dealing with people who, it seems to me, have divorced themselves from common sense.
Well, certainly appears that way. I mean, if you just look at the legislation that created the Waitangi Tribunal, there's no way it's a court. And yet we're seeing increasingly judges that are writing law from the bench. And that always ends in disaster.
Yes, and they're very, very prone to accept any Māori sob story. Now, I've spent much of my life arguing that Māori deserve a fair shake of the dice. But I went to a function not that long ago where the Chief Justice was to speak, and she spoke for about 20 minutes in Māori. And there was nobody there no Māori present as far as I could see. And quite why it was necessary, I do not know. It was discourteous, if nothing else.
Well, you're seeing this at all levels of the court system, because if you go and I've spent a fair bit of time in court, unfortunately, but 10 years ago, you would attend court, the registrar would come through the door and say, ask everybody to stand. While His Honour came in, he would stand up the front, nod to all the people there, sit down, and then the various lawyers would stand up and introduce themselves. And then, they might say, I'm Smith for the defence, or Jones for the prosecution. And then the judge would acknowledge them and just make a note, and then sit down and say, right, well, let's get going and start the process. It took about 5 minutes to do that. Now, however, particularly if there's any Crown solicitors involved or barristers representing aspects of the Crown or a Crown entity of some sort, you get these pepehas now where the judge comes in, there's about a 20-second or 30-second ramble in Māori, God knows what it says. The judge comes in, nods to everybody, sits down, and then they proceed to stand up and recite who all their ancestors were for 5 or 10 minutes each.
Is this in court?
In court, yeah. I couldn't believe it when I saw it. It's changed just in 10 years.
Bizarre.
So, it's probably just changed since we had a Labor government. But the government departments are the ones that are pushing all of this. And it is making justice confusing, because not everybody speaks Māori and not everybody is going to.
No.
Ever. And yet they're pushing this on everybody and sort of sniggering to themselves that you can't understand it and perhaps you should educate yourself. And that's the arrogance of it all.
Yeah, so it's exceedingly arrogant stuff. And that is one of the reasons why I think the opposition to Māori and Māori programs and Māori claims is so hostile and will get more hostile. It is the extraordinary arrogance of a lot of it.
And again, I think this comes back to the previous government, led by Labor and Labor in its entirety for the last 3 years, who promulgated this fanciful idea there was this co-governance. National stupidly, John Key stupidly signed the UNDRIP, which basically agreed to that sort of Indigenous rights. And I spoke to John Key about that, and I said, why did you sign UNDRIP? He says, oh, well, because there's no Indigenous people in New Zealand. And I said, you fool, there are now. Right? Yeah. And that's what Winston said, you know, that caused great consternation in the chattering classes when he said there's no Indigenous people from New Zealand. Everyone, their own whakapapa says that they came from somewhere else in canoes. And yet we've now got this idea that they've got Indigenous peoples, and then that goes into the co-governance arrangements of the Treaty of Waitangi, which were never in there. And as you point out in the article, you know, a proper translation, a realistic translation, it said the chiefs of the Confederation give absolutely to the Queen of England forever the complete government over their land.
Quite.
Full stop. That's it. It's no equivocating. There's no weasel words in there. There's no get out of jail clauses. There's none of that.
And the funny thing is, while that interpretation, which was done by Sir Hugh Carfrew, replaced the original text, and even the text of the treaty in English, and I've got it here in front of me, says that the Confederation of the United Tribes of New Zealand cede to Her Majesty the Queen of England absolutely and without reservation all the rights and powers of sovereignty. So there was no great surprise in Hugh Carfrew's translation. Where my point is that this doubt that you will find in various places about whether Maori ceded sovereignty is never backed up by any actual new translation of the treaty. They don't dare do that. They like to keep a degree of confusion because it suits Maori to reinterpret the treaty. It suits them to reinterpret all sorts of things. Tikanga is made up on the hoof. So it's one of the reasons why Maori is so opposed to David Seymour's idea of the treaty principles, because he would have something that was fixed and made clear in law. They want a fluid situation where they can reinterpret whenever they like, and the rest of us can fall into line. And it's all being done by a handful, a relative handful of people who are claiming that they're acting on behalf of oppressed Maori. Most of the so-called oppressed Maori wouldn't know who these guys were, or guyesses. It's all bull's wool.
And you're right. They never say where they've got this idea from. If you then point to a translation or the English version, then they say, oh, no, that's not what it means. It means something different now.
Yes, that's right. Well, they want confusion because they know that New Zealanders don't want to be labelled racist, and they don't want to be called out. But the reality is that most New Zealanders have reached the point where they've had a gutsful of this stuff. And I suspect that if it really came to a vote, Maori would have great difficulty getting very far. The immigration coming into the country is incredibly sour about the preponderance of effort that's being put into Maori. You've only got to look at the Auckland results in the election last year to see that.
Mm.
The Indians and that joined the Chinese, who joined many of the other ethnic groups, who just saying you can't give a preponderance of say on matters of government to people, a small number of people, on the grounds of some kind of bogus, and it is increasingly bogus ethnicity. I mean, you're looking at people who are 1/8, 1/16, 1/32 Maori, and claiming that that drop gives them a jump ahead of the new citizens, the white citizens, everybody else.
Well, you're seeing people, you know, in the media, like Phil Gifford, for example, who should just stick to commenting on sport because he knows a little bit about that. Not a great deal, but enough to get by and make a crust doing that, who proclaim that they've now discovered their Maoriness that was hidden from them in the past, and they're now what I like to call neo-Maoris. They've discovered this little minute piece of DNA, and somehow that minute piece of DNA is so powerful that they're entirely Maori now. And a case in point would be Willie Jackson, who has a very tiny percentage of Maori ancestry DNA, and actually, and in fact, has more Jewish DNA than he does have Maori DNA, but yet he's the right sort of Maori and is, in effect, probably one of the most vocal racists that there are in New Zealand politics today.
Yes. Well, I'm inclined to agree.
Mm. But again, we come back to the treaty, and I mean, you've noted that there's this, and I have to lay the blame of this at the feet of the media, where it's now probably impossible to eradicate this phony debate about what the treaty says and what it was intended to do. And as I said, I blame the media for that because they have not been critical. They've not said, hang on a second, but what about this? Or at any stage of it, they have embraced what Bob Jones calls Maori wonderfulness and have now turned their news organisations into organisations that are produce news stories that are filled with almost pidgin English now. Mm. Words being inserted for calling New Zealand a different name or all sorts of other things that go into it.
One of the interesting things was that the new government said that it wanted organisations to be called by their English names. Sure, they could have their Maori name tagged on, but Radio New Zealand has slipped, TV One has slipped, TV Three has slipped. They're all going back. The Herald, of course, never got off the Maorification bandwagon. And you're looking at a situation where they're thumbing their nose, all of them, at the government.
Well, you've got the situation where the previous government, again, I blame them for this, went about changing everything. We used to have the Ministry of Health, and then that was split into two, and both of the organisations were given Maori names. You know, we had Te Whatu Ora and something else. And all of a sudden, it was like this assumption that if you give something a Maori name, it'll be better. and we've seen from Kāinga Ora that that's not the case. You know, it's like them launching the supposedly fast rail solution between Hamilton and Auckland and calling it, naming it after a dead bird, thinking that that was going to make it fly. and it hasn't. It's highly subsidised. We've got a situation where 97% of the costs of that rail service are met by the state in various guises, either the local council or actually the state, and only 3% of the expenses of this massive boondoggle, so they could say they had train services between Hamilton and Auckland, is only 3% is met by the paying customers, of which there are a scant few.
Right.
But they gave it a Maori name, so it'll be better, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, Maori names. There's something in the Herald this morning, an article where a sentence begins with a couple of Maori words, and there's nothing to indicate what on earth they refer to, what it is that's being said. We've lost our way somehow, and it's insulting, really, to Maori to have inflicted upon them this silliness, which patronising Pākehā are inflicting on them.
I think it's mainly from the left type parties, Labour Party, Green Party, Maori Party. There's this patronising idea that Maori are helpless, that they can't do things for themselves, and therefore the state needs to step in and mollycoddle them at every level of society for everything they do, a separate health system, a separate education system, separate, everything separate, and that will give better outcomes. And there's no evidence for that, that that will ever work. And there's plenty of evidence to suggest that the apartheidization of New Zealand society won't work, right?
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Well, you know, co-governance and separate development, if you know anything about the rest of the world where those sorts of policies have been tried, you know to avoid them. And the notion that somehow or other Maori can have all of their things and bogus tikanga and bogus this and that, that we can all get on sweetly together while the rest of us kowtow to them, forget it. This country is capable of descending into ethnic warfare if there isn't an improvement.
Well, this tikanga thing is all driven by the same premise, isn't it?
Yep.
That our time-honoured judicial system, court system, legal system will be improved by adding tikanga but into the system.
And nobody can define what they really mean by tikanga.
But whose tikanga? Is it Ngāpuhi's tikanga, or is it is every iwi has its own tikanga?
Tūwharatoa's or wherever.
Wherever. Who's tikanga? And who says that this is going to make it better? It's not law.
That's the key question. People overlook the fact that, you know, there were only at the time of the treaty 100,000 Māori in New Zealand, in a country that now has well over 5 million. And, you know, they were scattered around in little groups, little linkage between them, except when a raiding party, a warlike party, set off to subject or subjugate them or to eat them. And there was a fair amount of that during the musket wars. I mean, the thought that each individual tribe had its own customs didn't seem to occur to people today who talk as though somehow or other there was some pan Māori tikanga, which there never was and never will be.
Well, it just can't.
You can't get them to agree. I mean, government starting with, I think it was Holyoke's in the 60s, tried to get a group that would speak for Māori as a whole. That was the origin of the Māori Council. And it never really worked. And in the end, you don't hear anything from the Māori Council today. I don't know whether it even exists anymore. But you do hear occasionally from the Iwi Leaders Federation, is it? Or the Iwi Chiefs Federation? I can't recall.
Something like that. Some precise
name. But even it it's incapable of actually binding all the iwi that it claims are gathered under it. And so the consequence is that there is no standard thing called tikanga and no standard customs or practices or anything, really.
And if you look, you know, you mentioned the musket wars. In 1821, Hongihika raided extensively against his rivals. This is just 19 years before the treaty was signed. He raided extensively in the Auckland and Coromandel region and captured in excess of 2,000 slaves and marched them back to Ngāpuhi lands. And, you know, 19 years later, I mean, he died in 1828, but in 1840, we're signing a treaty with the Crown. And the Crown in the UK at that time had abolished slavery, but the treaty allowed the various chiefs to keep all of their possessions, which included slaves.
Mm.
And we have to have this heroic assumption that Maori were this erudite, enlightened, wonderful group of people that were stunning navigators, but somehow couldn't boil water or make any implements with metal, were on an equal footing with a woman who would go on to be the Empress of India and the head of the British Empire.
Mm.
It's a fantasy, but we're supposed to not say anything about it, to nod sagely and agree that there was this partnership or co-governance unwritten in the treaty, but that was the intention of Captain Hobson and the British.
Mm.
I'm struggling with this.
Well, I think if you've got any questions, by all means fling them and we'll call it a day.
That's the thing. Is there a way out of this? Is there a solution to this activism from the Waitangi Tribunal and the imposition of tikanga and this belief that there was a co-governance arrangement, unwritten, unsaid, but it's there nonetheless? Is there a way out of this?
Well, governments have to be quite frank with this tiny number of people, and they are small. It is a small number who keep arguing this way all the time. Your great mass of Maori workers and truck drivers and nurses and so on don't believe any of this bull's wool, or at least don't care about it. Mm. But governments have to be firm and make it crystal clear that sovereignty was ceded in 1840, that all the governments since then have been legitimate governments, that Maori are entitled to their own political parties if they want them. But remember that you've got to abide by the rules that have been set by all.
Yeah, nearly 200 years of jurisprudence and lawmaking by legitimate parliaments that have represented in everybody's interests.
Quite. But until such time as governments are quite firm on those things, make it clear to Maori that they can advance their arguments in preferably a pan-Maori body that should be elected by all Maori to speak for Maori to government, instead of just having a few self-appointed experts, mokoed ladies from the University of Waikato or the Waitangi Tribunal or wherever.
Margaret Mutu, who I see has changed her name now to something else.
Yes, well, I mean, she's a disaster, poor soul. But
the media go to her every single time, though, don't they?
Well, you can count on her to say something that will give them a cheap and easy headline.
Yeah.
And away it continues to go. But there may be some people around who agree with Margaret Mutu. I confess I've never come across any.
And you've been around a long time to meet a lot of people. So.
Oh, she came along to the Waitangi Tribunal, I remember, on one occasion and sat in the back grumbling and saying that it was a disgrace that I could even ask certain key questions that were relevant to the case. You've got a real strange one there.
But she's the go-to person to the media. So that's where we come back to, isn't it? Isn't the problem that we've got in New Zealand society is a lack of responsible journalism and a lack of responsible editors and a lack of journalistic credulity about what all of these people that are pushing these agendas, no one's holding them to account, and they seem to be actually cheerleading and bandwagoning rather than actually doing their job.
That is true, but you have to go a step further. there is a real problem with the universities in this country now. Mm. They are in serious decline, and history and politics and so on, you know, there are very, very few really good, reliable academics left to straighten out the journalists, to educate them in the first place. And sad to say, this country at present is going through quite a decline.
Mm-hmm.
I find it quite distressing, really. But the best brains are departing. And some of the worst are in the media.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we can, you and I can solve the problems of the world, but maybe we should. But you're right. The politicians need to grasp the nettle. They need to not be afraid of upsetting a few rowdy people and start to make decisions around these sorts of things. As you pointed out, there's very few claims. In fact, I think there's only one major claim outstanding, which is Ngāpuhi. The day of the Waitangi Tribunal is over, really.
Oh, long gone. Mm. It's all, I mean, Margaret Mutu, we were talking about, she's at the centre of quite a lot of the trouble up there. I mean, it's a problem solving it, Ngāpuhi being a big variegated area with a lot of people living and working outside of the area putting their oar in from time to time and making it very difficult for the government to actually find a satisfactory solution. And every day that goes by while these people have their way and stop a solution is a day when Ngāpuhi fails to get the settlement resources, which they eventually will.
You know, I can remember a news article that showed Andrew Little, the Treaty Negotiations Minister at the time, with a very angry look on his face. It just, you know, he had the nickname Angry Andrew for a reason, or Angry Andy for a reason. He was an angry man, but he was at a meeting to try and progress the Ngāpuhi claim. And he got so frustrated, he was banging the table and somebody took a photo of it. And I actually felt sorry for Andrew Little at that point. And it's not often I have too much compassion for politicians. They enter the fray willingly. But in this instance, I actually felt sorry for him, that here he was trying to actually progress something.
Yep.
And was met with intransigence that you could not believe unless you were part of it. And well, I actually felt sorry for him.
Chris Finlayson had the same problem before that. I mean, he tried hard to get a settlement.
And he'd be the softest treaty negotiation person ever, Chris Finlayson. You know, he's a lock for Maori interests, Chris Finlayson, that's for sure. You know, and if he got frustrated by it, then it just shows you just how badly managed or badly controlled Ngāpuhi and the various hapū that are part of Ngāpuhi are letting the entire iwi down.
But Ngāpuhi is a sort of a microcosm of the wider problem of Māori in New Zealand. Nobody agrees with anybody else. They're all, singing their own songs and got their own version of tikanga. And Māori are a very difficult people when it comes to dealing with them politically. I'll bet you've got lots of Māori friends. I have.
Yeah.
You get on with them and they're wonderful.
Yeah.
But how have they got such jerks representing them?
Well, I mean, you know, we talked about the Waitangi Tribunal trying to elevate themselves to a judiciary, and you've mentioned that it would be good to have a pan-Maori organisation that could represent Maori, perhaps be elected. But we've seen a similar tactic, haven't we, in Tainui, trying to extend the Kingitanga movement to be a pan-Maori movement, which of course will never work because Ngāpuhi not going to listen to someone from Tainui, neither is Tu Whāritoa, neither is Ngāti Kahununu or anybody else. The Kingitanga movement is isolated to two areas of New Zealand, and the rest of Māoridom looks at them and goes, what are you trying to be, a white person? You know, a quasi king movement that was dreamed up because they thought it was a good idea. If England could have a queen, then we can have a king too.
Mm.
And people forget that.
Yes. I think we've exhausted our issues, but we'll talk again sometime.
Well, thank you very much for coming on again, Michael, and it's been a real pleasure. I always enjoy talking to Michael Bassett about politics. He's forgotten more than I remember about politics. And he's also such a gentleman, but he does have strong opinions on the excesses of a few Maori radicals who seem to have hijacked the Waitangi Tribunal. Let me know your thoughts by emailing inbox@realitycheck.radio or text to 2057.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057. That's 2057. Or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.